This is part two of a three-part podcast.
Okay, I think it's working. All right, so I've got Diana Leaf Christian on the phone, and by the phone I mean an actual phone, not a cell phone. A device where I believe it's currently illegal for the NSA to listen to this phone call without notifying me or getting a warrant. So we could speak more freely than we could on any other communication contraption, like over the internet or a cell phone.
Okay, let's do.
Okay, all right. So now we recorded a podcast recently, and after recording it, then it was like 3 or 4 hours long. It was very, very long, and the second half got destroyed. So somehow all of my recording stuff made it so it didn't work, and we lost half of it. And it, by lost, I mean like it lost just me. I apparently recorded you just fine, and so Cassie went through and she made notes of the things that we talked about so we can recover those again and try to get them down because they're important. But the funny thing is that this morning I've spent all this time gathering up equipment so I could record twice. I could record it two different ways simultaneously to make sure that nothing got lost. And then your internet went down. So, but at the same time, I also had prepared to record this whole other way, you know, just in case, like plan C. And it turns out we're now on plan C, and hopefully this will work out fine.
Okay.
Now, since we last talked, you sent me some articles to look at, and I looked at those. We got so much to talk about. And I've got a bunch of things to talk about our current situation here, and some things that I've been making realizations of. And reading, you know, this article that you sent to me, and you said you must read this because I wrote it with you in mind. And I read through it, and it's like, that does help me a lot. That is something. And of course, I totally agree. And at the same time, I disagree completely.
Am I surprised?
And this is like how all of our conversations go for always, ever.
Well, Paul, you know, when I talked to you earlier this morning, I said, could I say some basic foundational things before we start about how what you have said in your previous podcasts, there's a basic disagreement I have,
okay,
or maybe a clarification I'd like to request that I could make?
Bring it on.
Okay. Paul, what I notice you do is that you describe a particular kind of community that you have been involved in, and then you make statements.
True.
That I think are extrapolations from too small of a sample.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You describe intentional communities where various people live in the same house, and they share the same kitchen, and they have some shared meals. And you then make statements like, in communities, the kitchen is the place where the most conflict happens, meaning, you know, about food and cleanliness and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that that can be true in a community where everybody lives in a house and they share a kitchen. But that's one of the least statistically numerical kinds of communities that there are. It's a kind of community you'd find if you lived in a city and you wanted to live in a shared group house. But there's loads and loads and loads of co-housing communities in the U.S. Everybody lives in their own little housing unit. They've got their own kitchen. They share meals with others 2 or 3 times a week in their great big shared common house where they have a team of folks on a committee doing the cooking, arranged in advance. And then there's various kinds of rural communities and other kinds of communities where people live in their own house, apartment, lodging unit, cabin, or whatever. And so some of the things you say about community without you putting any parenthetical phrase, meaning communities like this particular kind, you're saying it's like true for all of them by implication, since you didn't say, you didn't modify your phrase, you see? So I'm thinking, hey, wait a sec, Paul, that's not accurate and it's not helpful. Could you be more precise, please? That's my request.
So if I've said that this is the case for all, then you are indeed correct. I am errant, and I need to qualify. And in fact, I think in the last week I've had 6 different people tell me that nobody can always be right. And my response to that is, no, it's easy for anybody to be right all the time. And basically, all you need to do is preface everything you say with the magic words, I think. Because you could say, I think the sky is green. And that statement is a true statement, always.
Because you really do think that. And nobody can argue with what you think.
They're if they argue with what you think, they're making a claim to having mind-reading skills.
Exactly.
And really, why are they having this conversation if they could just simply read your mind?
But I would like you to do something different, even if you don't mind my being so presumptuous, and I'm sure you won't, since you know me to be presumptuous, and that is to please not say, I think communities have a lot of trouble in the kitchen. Instead, I would rather you said, I think shared group household communities who share a kitchen have a lot of trouble in the kitchen.
Well, and this leads into a space where I know that you have become very frustrated with the phrase, intentional community.
No, I'm not frustrated with the phrase. I'm frustrated with generalizations that don't take into account the different kinds of communities and the fact that one can't make blanket statements about all of them unless one knows a lot and use qualifying words to be more precise. As a writer, I want people to be precise or else not make generalized statements because it's misleading and I think actually hurtful.
I think you're correct. I think if I'm making misleading statements that I need to stop doing that and I should qualify my statements accurately.
Thank you.
And I want to come back to where it is my understanding that you do not care for the phrase intentional community because it is too broad and that you wish it had more meat to it, more definition, more clarity.
No, actually, I would put it a different way.
Okay.
So here I'll try to say this succinctly. I think the phrase intentional community is absolutely fine. It refers to various different kinds of intentional communities. Some that have specific kinds of names, like co-housing neighborhood, or rural or urban eco-village, or shared group household, or rural back-to-the-land homesteading community, or gay community, or conference and retreat center community, or spiritual community of an eclectic flavor, or specific spiritual community of a particular kind of spiritual practice or religious community. And all of them are similar and different. How they're different is they have different reasons for existing, different common purposes or reason why they exist. And they're also similar and different in what legal structures they use to own themselves with if they own their property, different ways of owning property, different ways of having internal community finances. Are they independent income like most communities in the U.S., or are they income sharing with community businesses that everybody works for, like the famous Twin Oaks in Virginia. So when people say intentional community, I'm not frustrated when they use the phrase. I'm frustrated when they make a generalization as if they were all the same. See?
See, I thought you were moving away from intentional community and towards eco-village, at least. That was my impression like 5-6 years ago.
No, what you might have picked up, Paul, is that I'm very, very interested in eco-villages, rural, urban, and in between, and I live in one. I work teaching in the Eco-Village Design Education Program, a month-long program to help people learn how to create them. And I also am involved in the North American organization called ENA, E-N-A, having to do with eco-villages. And I go to the Gen Europe Eco-Village Conference in Europe sometimes, and I live in one. I'm also really interested in co-housing. So you see, there are two kinds of communities I'm especially interested in and delighted by, but I like all kinds. So see, I'm not trying to change the overarching umbrella phrase. I've just got, under the umbrella, there's these certain kind of communities I'm really interested in and I have a lot of delight in learning about. See?
I see. And I'm going to say that I believe that your position in this space may have changed since I remember sitting in a floaty chair talking to you on the phone for about 3 hours one day, and you were telling me about how this particular position that I'm expressing right now, that about how intentional community, you felt intentional community was allowing anybody and everybody in. And it was like you wished it had a little bit more definition to it. So that way it's kind of like, you know, because people would apply it to almost anything. And you wanted it to be something where it meant something a little bit more. And so you were transitioning to the phrase eco-village because you felt that there was a very clear definition for eco-village and you liked that much more. And so you were kind of stepping away from you personally felt like you're choosing to step away from the phrase intentional community and towards the phrase eco-village because it had more grit, more substance, more definition.
You know, I don't recall ever believing what you just described. And I can't recall ever having said that to you. So we're having a little bit of reality difference here. That's interesting. But I can tell you what I imagine I might have meant, which I may have not said clearly enough, which is anybody and their brother developer can put up a housing development, put a greenhouse somewhere and call it an eco-village for marketing purposes. And various developers do that. Or people who don't understand what an eco-village really, really is, which I understand because I study it so thoroughly and I'm so involved in international movements about it, that some group of folks are going to create an intentional community, so they call it an eco-village. So I will say to them, well, in what way is it like an eco-village? And then they will say some words that indicates to me that they have no idea what an eco-village is. They just think it's a cool term, so they're using it. Also, it's marketable.
Right.
And I'll say, do you mean that you thought maybe because you had houses facing the south that made it an eco-village? And they say, yeah. And I say, well, there's more to it. May I tell you the more to it? You see, that's what I think I may have said to you. I don't like the term eco-village being used when it isn't really an eco-village, just for purposes of marketing or because people are well-informed and, I mean, uninformed but well-meaning. That I do remember thinking, because I still think it, and possibly saying. So please forgive me if I misled you.
I think that that's always been your case, and the thing that you enjoy about the word eco-village is that it has a very clear definition, and so you could then turn and say, here is what is clearly defined as an eco-village, and I know you've quoted it to me several times, and then you would go and say, you know, so let's take a look and find out if what you're calling an eco-village really is, and then you would oftentimes say, turns out no, this is not an eco-village, you're just using the term for your marketing, which is a bit unfortunate.
That's what I might say to Mr. or Ms. Developer, who is basically kind of clueless and commercially minded. But for folks creating a community, I would be considerably more diplomatic, and I don't think I would say to them, that's not an eco-village. I just try to give them some information. But since your listeners may be wondering, what the heck is an eco-village, let's just briefly say that now.
Go for it.
Okay. There's a classic definition, which I'll say in a minute. But first, I'd like to say the simple, straightforward one that's easy to picture, which is that it's a group of folks who may live in an urban, suburban, semi-rural, or rural area. Please don't think it's only rural. And they're really, really interested in learning and then teaching others what they have learned about ecological sustainability. Excuse my burps. And if it is social stability, sustainability, meaning that they have their own governance and decision-making. They make their own agreements. You might say their own zoning regulations for their own selves and how they live and who makes these decisions. They do. How do they make it in a participatory way? Then they might want to share that. So I call that ecological sustainability and social sustainability. If they're rural and they need the people who live there to be able to make a living, they might have various things they have done to help there be businesses or to support various entrepreneurs among the members to create their own cottage industries and then hire other folks, in which case they're looking at also economic sustainability. But that's just in rural ones. Not only that, these places are seeking to help others become encouraged, inspired, and motivated to do similar things in their own lives, in their own homes, wherever they live. So they generally have classes and workshops and tours. LA Eco Village is a very urban one. Dancing Rabbit in Missouri is a very, very rural one. Earth Haven Eco Village, where I live, is in the mountains, in the forest, but it's not so far from small towns, and it's only an hour from the big, beautiful town of Asheville. So there, you see, that's a little bit about eco villages. Here's the classic definition: a human-scale, full-featured settlement where human activities are harmlessly integrated into the natural landscape in a way that fosters healthy human development and which can be continued into the indefinite future. This is from Robert and Diane Gilman, and I think I got a few words wrong, but you get the picture. And what it means is, human scale means we can know everybody, and we're not a cog in the wheel with a bunch of people that we don't know. So it's small enough that we know everybody, but how small is that, or how big is that? 100 people, 150, 500 people, I don't know. full featured. We live there. We work there. Our social life is there. Our spiritual life is there. We can leave any time and go do something else, but we don't have to meet our basic needs for stuff like food and shelter and friendships. Harmlessly integrated into the natural landscape means we're not really hurting the air, the trees, the forest, the water, and future generations by using up resources and polluting everything to the degree that we can. And human activities, let's see, we're not going crazy with working too much. We still have peaceful lives with some free time. And into the indefinite future is sort of like that Six Nation Iroquois statement about you have to think about what you're doing for seven generations into the future. We have to think that we're not borrowing resources from future generations, but rather we're making things better for future generations. So we've got our eyeball on our great-great-great-great-great-grandkids. That's it.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to the... I'm going to go ahead and say that there's you, Diana Leaf Christian, and then in my mind, so that way you'll be comfortable with what I'm about to say, there is a Diana Leaf Christian puppet, which which said a thing in my memory, and I'm gonna tell you what the puppet in my head said, and then I'm looking forward to hearing your comments on the puppet in my head.
Okay.
All right. So now, 6 years ago, I remember sitting in this floaty chair and having this lovely conversation with you. And it did seem like once a year we would have this immensely long conversation, which eventually had to end due to the rest of the world pressing in on us, and we had to get back to it. But 6 years ago, I remember that the puppet said that that she did not care for the phrase intentional community because somebody could go to IC.org and say, I have an intentional community. And there wasn't really any filter for being able to state, I choose to call this an intentional community. I have taken four sticks, and the puppet didn't say this. I'm making this up to help exaggerate the point. I have taken four sticks and drawn smiley faces on them and propped them up around a table, and me and my sticks formed an intentional community, so therefore I'm stating it at IC.org that we have this community, and there's five of us here, me and the four sticks. And apparently that, meets their criteria. Basically, if you think you have an intentional community, it is therefore an intentional community. And you kind of felt that the puppet felt that it would be good to have standards and to say, like, okay, there has to actually be at least three people there, or something. So there was that is what I have this memory of, which must be a false memory.
Can I respond?
Yes, please. That's what I'm fishing for, is your response.
Okay. The details of what was bothering me is accurate. The way it is, the way you have had the puppet frame it, isn't accurate as far as I can remember. I don't think I ever disliked the phrase intentional community because I have been for 20-some years an advocate of using that phrase instead of commune. Commune is the phrase that I ask people to please not use unless they mean literally a commune, which is an income-sharing community. That's a commune. And I think communes are fine. I just like to use precise language. Why? Because I'm a writer and also perhaps I have too many planets and something. Anyway, I don't dislike and never have disliked the term intentional community. In fact, I have been promoting it year after year after year, especially when somebody wants to call a place a cult or a commune. I say, excuse me, could you please call them an intentional community? And if you don't like them, please don't call a cult. Just say that you don't like them and then say why. Anyway, back to the story. So, yes, I felt sad that when newcomers to communities look on the directory.ic.org website, they'll see all kinds of entries in there which are not exactly communities yet. There's two people with an idea or one person with an idea or two people with some land and nobody else. And Yet I understand that the FIC, the Fellowship for Intentional Community Nonprofit that makes this wonderful website, cannot, does not have the person, power, time, hours, or money to screen every single person who writes an application online and then ends up in the directory. Because, you see, it's self-created. The FIC doesn't screen them. They don't put the entries in. The people just fill out a form, and then, voila, it appears online under the state or province that they're in. So I feel sad that people could get misled. So in my book, Finding Community, in the chapter on how to use directory.ic.org, I said, if the two founders have been on the land a long time, because you can look at the date that they got founded, and there's only two members and there's some land, something isn't working out too well. If there's only one person or two people and no land, this means they're in the early stages. But if they founded themselves a long time ago and there's still no land and they're not intending to be non-residential, something's not working out too well. If they have a name like Fairy Dust Heaven Angel Breath, then probably they're not very realistic and they may not be using effective project management because they came up with a name like that. That's often correlated to fuzzy thinking. Not always, but often there may be something not so great. So I'm trying to help people know how to use that wonderful resource. Has it been going for a while? Are there a number of people there, not just one or two? Do you see what I mean? When you click over to their website, does it look like there's real people doing really real things? Instead of a bunch of visionary, idealistic, theoretical, visionary words on the page with little pictures of angels? Or is it you can see pictures of people with shovels actually gardening and doing real things, and they've been there a while, and they actually tell you about their history? That's what I want people to know is a place they could visit and maybe consider joining.
I have to say that IC.org, I haven't been out there for probably 6 years, 5 years to the website, but I can say what an amazingly excellent resource. I really like how a person can go there and filter. First, they can find out, you know, which intentional communities are just nearby,
mm-hmm.
You know, which ones you might be able to go visit. But also, like, for the things that well, I'm just going to say things that I might be interested in, I could filter and say, okay, I want a community where there isn't any smoking, and I could filter for that to some degree.
Yeah.
And then I could say, I'm interested in something that where there's permaculture. I can search for that and narrow it down. I've got probably 40 hours of my time put into the IC.org directory, looking at all the different communities in my area or across the world for different things. And it seems like about a third of them are forming, and a third of them are currently like accepting new members, and then there's all kinds of different stories for the other third. But what a great way to start to learn about this kind of thing.
I agree completely. When somebody wants to know about intentional community, I give them the following advice. I say, do you have an afternoon free with internet service? And they'll say yes. And I'll say, okay, go to directory.ic.org and read what different communities say about themselves and click to their websites and read what they say on their websites. And then click back and go read another one. Another thing you can do is go to YouTube, and in the little place that you type something in, type in co-housing, type in eco-village, type in commune, type in shared group household, and you'll see videos of different people telling you about their projects, and so you get a nice moving visual. And in a couple of hours, you can know so much.
Right. It really does start to paint a good, clear picture. Now, of course, you know, while reading that and then looking through that and having your two books, I think is kind of the essential combination to be able to move forward and what one might do to actually move to one of these. But I just want to say that for people that are considering community living, that this is the big resource. I want to change gears for a little bit, if that's all right, and that
sure.
is that with our conversation that we had this morning before we started recording, combined with some of the emails that we exchanged, combined with our conversation from the last time, I need to express a couple of quick things about me, my favorite topic, me. first of all, I want to express that you've mentioned that you've actually used the words arrogance and ego, I think, in our last podcast recording session. And
not about you, though.
Oh, even if you did, that's perfectly fine. But I don't think you did about me. But I wanted to express that I hope that of all the people that you encounter, that I'm the one with the most arrogance and ego. I hope that there's nobody worse than me that you ever encounter. But I kind of feel like much like what you in that article that you sent me proposes is that a person that is and maybe we should talk about this article, but I'm going to set that aside for a moment. And it's like the point is that to seek some guidance and some possible something or another to help a person be able to work better with others, kind of a thing. And
well, could I give the basic outline of what it is that I wrote so that people listening will know what we're talking about?
So I think actually, you know what? I want to put that off for just a little bit. And
okay.
And what I want to do is I want to say that for a great deal of my life, I tried to I embraced the idea that I am not different from others, that my voice is equal to all other voices, and that it would be arrogant of me to assume anything otherwise, and I need to not be this arrogant person. And I got to say that to this day I still struggle with even the definition of what is ego. What does ego even mean? I have no idea. I sometimes feel like I have a bare glimpse of it, and I've looked it up. I don't know how many times, and it's like it's confusing to me. I kind of assume that because I don't understand what it means, I must have this like in such a vast amount that the description of like, oh, ego is a problem. It's like, I don't understand. It's a problem. I can't comprehend what it means. I've had when people complain about me and I read from my detractors, it's like, oh, Paul Wheaton, he's so obnoxious and he has this huge ego and so arrogant and all this stuff. It's like, I'm having a hard time understanding what all that's all about. But, the key is that there got to be a point where I came to the conclusion, this is my own personal thing,
mm-hmm.
where the attempt to be not arrogant was holding me back. And the idea that I needed to help other people or to converse with them about a potential idea that I had that may or may not have merit, that there got to be a time where I came to the conclusion of that, like, arrogance is my superpower of sorts. and that actually this is who I am. And so rather than try to be a person that does not have arrogance, that was the road to misery for myself and for anybody around me. It was a pathetic, miserable existence. And so what I have elected to do, which I'm sure is not cool in your world, is to be who I really am, which is this arrogant, by the standards of others. By the standards of myself, it's glorious and awesome. By the standards of others, I am an arrogant son of a bitch. I am a shithead, a fucker, an asshole, a dick. But it seems that to those people, I don't give a shit that they think I'm arrogant, a dick, an asshole, whatever. I've decided to move on a path where I'm going to act on the things that I think are fucking awesome, and that I embrace that 95% of the population is going to be utterly, profoundly offended that I choose this path, and I am okay with that.
Can I respond?
Okay.
Or were you not done yet?
I think I'm done enough.
Okay. You've said so many things, and I have many responses. And the first is, why do I, a discriminating person who's actually pretty picky about who she will allow to talk to her, why do I like you so much? That's one thing.
Because we're alike.
Okay, but I don't think that either you or I are arrogant. Well, I think I am sometimes, but not so much anymore. And I don't think that you and I are all those negative things you said. Also, this word ego, I think that it's a word, like many words in English, that is completely meaningless because so many people mean different things by it. Somebody might say you have a big ego to mean that you are pretty sure about what you're saying. In other words, you have confidence in your data. Somebody might say you have a big ego if they disagree with you. Somebody might say you have a big ego if you feel happy about yourself and your life and you're not fraught with self-abnegation or shame. And they are, and they think that you're putting them down by your very existence because you're happy and you're confident. They can call that ego. Is that ego? I don't think it is. I think ego is a word, like if we took the word bleh, and we just made up this word bleh, and we said, you're a bleh, and that's like a free-form insult word. It can mean anything you want, like a Rorschach inkblot test. And then I could say, Paul is a bleh, and then you could say, well, Diana's a bleh. And who would know what it meant? It doesn't mean anything. It means anything you want it to mean. So I think we should all throw the word ego out of our vocabulary. Whatever the heck Freud meant when he made it up, or from whatever Greek or Latin source, he pulled the word out. So what? Let's throw it out. Why don't we get more clear? Some people don't like you. Some people don't like me. Some people don't like the kind of people that we are, which I would say is happy and confident and pretty sure of what we know. What I know that I need to do is get much, much better communication skills than I had before. And let me knock on some wood here. I have better ones now than I did, but I ain't perfect yet, and I'm trying to be. Why? Because I would like to be more effective in this world. I'd like to be effective in my own community, among my friends, everywhere I go to teach workshops and do consultations, when I'm presenting to a conference, you know, full of people. I'd like to have a demeanor and an energy that is easy for people to empathetically connect with so that what I have to say to them will be helpful. And so that any aspects of my personality they wouldn't like don't actually come up right then, so that that doesn't get in the way. And some advice that I might want to give them or some insights or some things that I've learned from my research about communities can truly pass over to them and they can consider it. So back to this thing that I wrote, this article. This article is called Advice for Early Adopters, The Bell-Shaped Curve of Community. And it's a chapter that's going into my third book. And it says, here's what I've observed in groups, that it's like a bell-shaped curve. A mathematical model I didn't come up with, some mathematician somewhere did, which looks like the shape of a bell because there's not very many people over on the far left or the far right, and there's this big curve that goes upwards in the middle. I'm sure people listening can picture this because they've seen this in books before, the bell-shaped curve. Way over on the left is people I call early adapters. People in the middle, the great big part of the bell, is people I call people in the middle. What they're like usually is they're like nice folks who don't necessarily analyze things, who don't necessarily have intellectual analysis and don't speak in logical linear outline form. Generally what they want to know is, hey, can't we all just get along? Generally what they're doing is wanting to start some things sometimes and help things move forward sometimes and get along well with folks. People way on the left, though, there's very few of them in any group compared to everybody else. And I'm not picking the left because of left and right politics. I just picked the left because I was drawing this curve, and that's where I ended up putting these people. These people are people who are very, very confident. They probably got really good grades in school. Probably other people consider them smart. They may or may not consider themselves smart because they're so used to their own mind, they don't think of it very much. They tend to be self-empowered. They tend to be able to be entrepreneurs, if not literally entrepreneurs. They tend to be able to say, hey, let's do this, and then they can make a plan, and they can visualize it and organize it and encourage people and help make it happen. They tend to be articulate. Did I say confident? Okay. The downside of these folks is that they can be arrogant. That is to say, they cannot be very sensitive about how they come off to others, and their extreme confidence can be just a little irritating to some others sometimes. They can often think they're right, and they know they're right, and you're wrong, and I'm right. that can happen. They also, but the biggest thing is impatience. They tend to be, in their perception, surrounded by people who think more slowly, respond more slowly, need a little time and energy to think about things and ponder them for a while. And this tends to drive them cuckoo because they like to do things at lightning speed. Why? Because they can. Because they do. Lightning speed is how they function. They're surrounded by people who seem to be moving more slowly. I don't mean less smart. I just mean moving more slowly. And so what do these people put out as an energy? Irritation, impatience, and impatience. And so let's go to the other side of the bell-shaped curve. Who are these folks? Oh, I call these people systems thinkers, too. Systems thinkers because they generally think that if we did this, then there are these possible outcomes, and there are these possible outside influences and inside tendencies that will influence this. But if we changed it like this, then it might have this outcome. But if we changed it like that, it might have that outcome. They're thinking in past, present, future outline form of possible outcomes. Paul, you do that. I do that. Most people don't do that, but people who do it think that everybody does it, but they don't. Okay, so people on the other side, they might be systems thinkers too.
I want to jump in and say something really quick. And basically it's like I agree with all of your analysis, and I want to – the thing you just said I think is so important. And it's like this kind of thinking – that the reason why that they assume that everybody else thinks this way is because they're told everybody is equal.
Which is not true.
And it's like, but then when you're young and you're told everybody is equal, okay, then everybody is doing the exact same thing that I'm doing in my head.
Exactly.
We're thinking this through. We're playing chess. We're like, we can see if you, A leads to B leads to C leads to D. So therefore, you know, A is a good idea because we all want D. Duh, it's obvious. But then other people, their brains work in a different way. We are not equal. They do different things. A lot of people just want to have a beer and watch the game.
Yes, but I'm not even going to use the word equal and not equal because of the connotation and the charge on that. I'd like to use more precise words, me being a writer who likes to be precise, and that is I'd say that people have different shapes and activities in their mental and their emotional selves. Some people are all about feeling empathetically how others are feeling and feeling connected to them or noticing when they're not connected. I have two good friends here at Earth Haven who are like that. I'm not like that, but them being like that is helpful to me because I'm kind of learning by being in their energy field and by watching what they do. Meanwhile, I'm thinking at the speed of light, and I'm leaving them in the dust, and I have to go back and tell them what I meant because they say, what? What was that? I don't understand. And so I go back and tell them. I have a friend who's like this. But she is more like this than I am. She went to law school and aced it. She didn't even have to study. She passed the bar without even thinking about it. This woman is brilliant. Quite often, I cannot follow her. Her mind thinks in logical linear form at lightning speed. Her sentences are long and convoluted with many parenthetical expressions. And sometimes I have to go, hold on, excuse me, I didn't understand. Could you say that again? But because I'm so confident nowadays, after the 100 and then 200 years therapy, because I'm so confident, I don't ever stop to think that I might be stupid or something. I just want to know. So go, hold on, I didn't understand. Could you say that again? So after about 6 times, I do understand her because she slows it down and makes me able to understand. Well, I know that I have this effect on some people sometimes. But let's go to the other side of the curve. Some of these folks here might be systems thinkers. Some of these folks might be and probably are super smart. But what they might be is having a really difficult time doing daily life on planet Earth, having a really difficult time feeling good enough to get through the day without suddenly reacting as if someone is trying to attack them or harm them or victimize them, who might have rage just under the surface or feelings of self-abnegation just under the surface, which comes up lots over very little, and other people think, why are they so upset? What did I say? Because they get upset frequently, often over seemingly nothing. And so if their system thinkers are really, really smart, it's a little bit hard to tell. So I'm not saying these are dumb folks, and I'm not saying anything other than I think they might have been super traumatized at some point in their history, and the trauma cycle hasn't completed and moved on through their system. So they're neurologically and biochemically a little bit stuck in the place where they're going to be reactive. And they have not yet done the simple self-healing things you can do for trauma or psychotherapy with a counselor or somebody to get back to their real self again. So they're living in the community, having lots of reactivity. Okay, then there's the people in the middle, who's most people, who say, hey, why can't we all get along? Okay, the people on the far left, people like you and me, scare the bejesus out of the people on the far right. They think that these people think they're better than them, and they might think that, and they think that they're out to get them, that they're out to victimize them, and they're trying to hurt them. This if this was in a normal organization like a company, well, the people on the far right wouldn't have been hired, and the people on the far left would be warned by the supervisor to try to get along with people better. And if they were in a neighborhood or just some area of the country, some location, there would be no problem for the people on the far left. But if you put them in an intentional community and you give that intentional community a decision-making method where everybody has an equivalent voice and anybody can stop anything that the group wants to do anytime for any reason and there's no recourse, known as classic consensus or consensus with unanimity, which I mean anybody can say no to anything at any time with no recourse. There's other kinds of consensus decision-making where there is a recourse when someone blocks a decision, and you have to make sure the block was legitimate and that other people think so too. Or there's other things that groups can do. But back to the kind of consensus that I think many communities used to think was the right kind to use. Anybody can block anything at any time for any reason, and there's no recourse. When you put people who are feeling hesitant and cautious about life and other people, suspicious of other people, and who get reactive often, in a group where you have equivalent decision-making, the people on the far left will make proposals and the people on the far right will block them.
Right. And in your article, it's the pushers are on the left side.
Uh-huh, and the slower downers.
Oh, I thought I got from the article the stoppers.
Well, sometimes they stop altogether and sometimes they slow down. It depends on the governance system used in the community or the organization. Okay, so what I'm doing is trying to help people who are on the far left who are frustrated to understand what's happening, because they will be criticized, marginalized, and made out to be villains when in fact they have wonderful gifts with which they can help the community meet its goals. What will happen if they're using a kind of decision-making method where people can stop things or slow them down because of feeling cautious or suspicious, what will happen is the people on the far left who have many, many options for how to have a good life will leave the community. They will leave first. Or if they can't leave because they can't get their money out or something, or they for some reason they cannot, they'll simply withdraw from the governance. And they'll live there, but they won't participate. And the people on the far right never leave the community. It's too hard to make a decision and then organize to have the finances and the physical logistics that you need to actually up and move. The people in the middle say, gosh, I wish everybody could just get along. The people on the far left will analyze this, and they'll have an analysis like the one I'm doing. The people on the far right will think, why are you victimizing me? You're attacking me. You're harming me. So the people on the far left will say to the people in the middle, hey, those people over there are a problem. And the people in the middle will turn and look at the people on the far left and say, how can you say that? That's so unkind. Don't you have any empathy or compassion? Where is your heart? Don't you realize these people had an unhappy childhood? And the ones on the left will say, speaking very rapidly, I don't care if they had an unhappy childhood. Why don't they get some therapy like I did? Or maybe they didn't get therapy yet, in which case I suggest they do. I mean, the ones on the far left, my advice for people on the far left is get therapy. That's my advice to me, and I follow it. But the point is, oh, please, you are going to be seen as the problems in the community, not the ones on the far right. Why aren't the people in the middle going to see the people on the far right as a problem? Because they have compassion and empathy, and they want to connect with them, and they want to have an empathetic connection. They're not thinking logical, linear, how can we help the community meet its goals? They're thinking, how can we all get along? So here's what I suggest, in case you're feeling like a marginalized and criticized person on the far left in your organization or community, get some good communication skills, like nonviolent communication or non-defensive communication. Learn how to speak in a way that connects to other people before you start to outline your 12 points of your fabulous idea. Don't walk up to somebody and go, hi, hey, listen, I got this great idea, and then lay out the 12 points with the subpoints. Instead, say, hi, how are you doing? Did your aunt get better? Did she get back to Kansas City okay? And you know what? It's a little bit like learning another language, and you have to. Why? Because you want to be effective. Why do you want to be effective? Hey, you came to this planet to get a lot done, to accomplish things, to change the world. You're a visionary. You've got these gifts you've been given, confidence, self-empowerment, brains, and you want to use them, and you keep getting stopped. Why? Your mouth, your energy. You got to learn, hey, your mouth and your energy is beneficial, and it gets in your way. Learn how to speak that other language. So I'm on this, like, lifelong campaign to learn the other language, to do lots of healing of my own edgy, agitated issues, and to become a person who can function well in any part of this bell-shaped curve. End of soapbox oration.
I think that if you go into community in a way where you've got, let's say, 10 or 20 people that have an equal share in the community, then what you've just said is absolutely correct. If you cannot communicate with these people, you have to have good communication skills, which would include the thing about, you know, learning how to relate in the terms of and in fact, it's kind of a language. When you just said the thing, how is your Aunt Sally or something of that nature, then to me, that's the language that is on the far right. Not necessarily that they're attempting to stop, but it's more like the way that they communicate is more about empathy and sympathy and, you know, understanding and feelings.
Well, the people in the middle, too. But it's not like they don't logically linear or come up with proposals and head up committees and make things happen. They just don't do it with the same frequency and intensity as
Absolutely.
The ones on the far left.
Absolutely. They're a hybrid, if you will, and they are the majority. They are by far the majority. They're 95%. They've got a little of, and then of course if you look at the bell curve, there's some people that are a little bit to the left, and some people a little bit to the right.
Right.
Some people have a little bit more logic and reason, and some people have a little bit more empathy and sympathy, and these are their communication styles. And it's kind of like if you wish to blaze a trail with your community, then you're going to need to communicate with the way that the majority communicate.
Yeah, you need to learn another language so you can speak the language of regular folks who are good-hearted people who can help make things happen. So, Paul, my belief is that who has the power in any community is the people in the middle. And so one of my advices to myself was to make friends with people in the middle, and when I had an idea for something I wanted to have happen in community, to ask them, after some empathetic connection, if they thought it was a good idea and if they had any ideas, and then we would co-create the thing to happen, and they would be in the front, they'd be leading it, I'd be in the background doing various clerical tasks to assist them. So they'd be in the front person. So there's lots of things that have happened at Earthhaven that I helped happen, but nobody knows it except, you know, the friends I did it with. After doing this calculated making friends with people in the middle thing that I did, and after more hundred years of therapy, I actually began to enjoy their company so much that it became its own reward to be friends with some of my wonderful friends in the middle.
Now, in your article, you made a couple of statements about the people on the left, and I think we're both agreed that I'm on the left. And and your suggestion was that they need to seek different forms of therapy. And you also mentioned, you know, learn better communication skills. And I'm just gonna go on the record as saying I have never seen a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I understand they're different, and I don't know how.
They are. They're different.
Okay. Or a psychotherapist or anything in that space, mm-hmm. anybody in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I have studied intensively communication things,
mm-hmm.
dominantly because, you know, I would find myself in work situations or even non-work situations where I wished to be persuasive. I wished to, why don't these people understand what I'm saying? And so I did study a lot of that, and I got to understand a fair amount of it. And at the same time, I wished to share something I believe I've never shared before.
Mm.
And that is that my childhood was very different. I lived with a lot of different families. And so it was hard and awesome at the same time. So I got to be in some families that were really yucky, and I got to be in some families that were really, truly wonderful. And I got to see firsthand, up close, what a really loving family looks like. And in this particular family, it was expected that if you received a gift, you would send a thank you card. And that if enough few months have passed, you would send a personal letter to just say, hi, how are you? And then basically exactly what you said a moment ago, how is Aunt Sally?
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. What I learned is that while I really love to see these people and I very, very much wish to be a part of their world, I'm not wired that way.
Mm-hmm.
These people are so close to each other, the idea that they would go 4 months without physically being in front of each other for a week is unthinkable. And whereas I could easily pop away for several years. And then, you know, you would send everybody a card for every holiday or a gift for birthdays and Christmas and maybe even other times of the year. And they're that close. But at the same time, I feel like while I am not wired to be in that role, and it is a beautiful thing to witness, and I believe mm-hmm. I have seen true beauty
mm-hmm.
by witnessing these people, I believe it's like my Achilles heel, my doom, my curse to not be able to be part of anything like that, while at the same time, because of that curse, if you will, then I have superpowers and other things.
Exactly. People on the left have, quote, superpowers and other things, and they tend to be not so good at the thank you notes and the how's Aunt Sally. But I believe that if you want to live functionally in a community, it's helpful to attempt to learn some of those things, even if you have to fake it till you make it for a while. However, Paul, I think you have a whole different way of approaching this, which is to say, look, this is the kind of person I am, and if people want to call me names like ego and arrogant, well, let them, and then let me create a community where I just invite the folks that I really, really want to invite, and then we together do it, and I'm the boss. And if people are fine with that, then it's fine. I actually think that can work just fine, because you'll get the people who are willing to do that, who are perfectly happy doing it, and you won't get the people who aren't. So, harmony. That's what I think.
I have people who need to talk to me about things all the time, and I have caused, I don't know, I'm going to go with hundreds of people crying. I remember I worked at a job once, and they came to talk to me, like some executive came to talk to me and said, okay, all of the people in all of human resources are currently crying, and they've been crying for hours because of something you said.
Oh, my God, Paul.
And we're now working on doing something to take them out to try and get them to calm down, you know. And you know, I wish I could say that that was a one-time thing, but I make people cry a lot. And that's just, I'm so used to it, I am totally unaffected by somebody crying. And frankly, I think of it as a type of fallacy. I am crying, therefore you must comply with what I'm asking of you. And my response is, that's fallacy. I'm not going to do it. I'll wait until you're done crying. I'm really good at waiting until you're done crying.
You know what, Paul? When a person is crying, it could mean this crying is a little act that I'm putting on in order to force you to give me what I want. Or it could be, I'm crying so that you'll feel sorry for me, so that you'll feel guilty, you brute. Or it could be, I feel so sad right now. So if you ever see me crying in your presence, please don't think I'm doing something on you. I might just be really sad.
No, I think you are so authentic that you would never try to pull a thing like that with anybody.
Well, I wouldn't now, but that's after the hundreds of years of therapy that I've had. Because when I was young and exceptionally neurotic, less so than now, I had compulsions, and one of my compulsions was to get therapy, fortunately for all my friends and for me and for my life. So this compulsion, you know, people can have compulsion to wash their hands, you know, like Howard Hughes, or they can have different other weird compulsions. Mine was to get outside healing help, thank God. And so I kept getting outside healing help with my relentless compulsion. Now I'm less relentless and less compulsive and easier to know. And a person like you likes me just fine, and people who are completely different than me like me just fine, unless I piss them off royally in the past, in which case they will never forgive me ever, which is the way it works sometimes with people on the far right. They'll never forgive you ever. You're a monster and an ogre, and that's that. So that happens. Interesting, huh?
It does, and I know of people that, and basically it's a couple of different things. I mean, I will add in one little thing, and that is that when I was 18 years old, then my granddad, who was an awesome man, sent my aunt, an awesome woman, over to see me, and I was living by myself at the time, and the concern was my granddad felt that I was despondent. And I had to look that up in a dictionary. I don't know if people even know what dictionaries are anymore, but this was an age before Google, and so I had to look it up in a dictionary. But basically, there was a girl who seemed, you know, but basically, my aunt, who was an awesome person, and it turns out a counselor. I told her what was going on in my life and how frustrated I was by, you know, what this woman was saying to me and everything, and. And in 1 minute, she said magic words. I don't even remember what the magic words were. But she said these magic words all within 1 minute. And then everything in my life made sense and everything was right as rain.
Mm-hmm.
And I could then move on with my life, which was an amazing, powerful thing. And I just assume that most psychologists, psychiatrists, and people in that space, they have this enormous buffet of magic words. And
no, I don't think they do. I think your aunt did, but I think most of them are basically not that good at it.
Well, I think that there's a high probability of that as well. However, I do believe that they're possibly provided with mini books of magic words. And they're like, when somebody is going down this path, and it's then you say these magic words, and then they go, everything is good. So, at the same time, I think a less expensive possible path is, like, you have good friends, and you tell your good friends these crazy things that are in your head, and then every once in a while, a good friend will say, well, that's crazy if you thought about blah, 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 and then suddenly they accidentally stumbled upon the exact same magic words, not because they have the training, but because they give a shit about you.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there is that. Now, I've got to point something out here that's very important to what you're saying. You're saying seek professional help, and so you can become a better communicator and not, you know, be mean to people and stuff like that. And I got to say that it turns out that there are several people that are of this psychiatrist, psychologist space that listen to all of my podcasts. And I've met a couple of them, and they've talked about how, you know, this is their full-time day job is helping people. And because they've listened to all my podcasts, I ask them this very obnoxious question. I say, well, it's as if I've been on your couch for hundreds of hours, and what is your analysis of me? And I've actually visited with three people where this is their full-time job, and I've asked them this question after they've told me that they're a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they say, you, sir, are the most sane person I have ever listened to. So I'm kind of feeling like it's okay for me to not go in and seek professional help, but it's been a long road for me as well as it's been for you, and I'm sure many people, to like, why do other people seem so crazy? And I remember 20 years ago or so when I was trying to understand, like I was trying to be a better communicator, I remember reading what I believed to be a very good book on the topic. I can't remember what the book was called, but at the very end of the book, it said something that I thought was very fascinating. And I embraced for a while, although and I've since changed my philosophy. And so I agreed with the book then, and now I don't. What the book said is that if you are surrounded by jerks, then you have to consider the fact that you are most likely the jerk. So for a while, then I adopted that. And I think that that is a very healthy approach when you're assuming that we are all equal and that we all have an equal say and we just think about things differently. And since then, I have embraced my arrogance and come to the conclusion that if I am surrounded by jerks, then I'm surrounded by jerks. That it is true that I will be a jerk by their standards, and therefore I'm the jerk. But it is not true that I need to change myself. That, in fact, I'm on a mission that's different than these people that all think I'm a jerk. And if I was on their mission, then yeah, I should change myself so that I am aligned with their mission. But my mission is different. And my mission is to be on that left side of your scale, to be mm-hmm. that pusher instead of a stopper.
Mm-hmm.
And by being a pusher, by being a person that's going to try and break new ground, mm-hmm. that it is going to be extremely offensive to the majority. Oh, sorry, I just got landed on by a bug. Go away, bug. Actually, we've got these bugs here. They're Western conifer seed bugs. And people refer to them as stink bugs. But the funny thing is that these bugs, if you smash them, or if they get angry and they make their stinkums come out, mm-hmm. it actually smells like green apples and pine. It actually smells kind of nice. If you want to make your house smell nice, you smash a bunch of these bugs. They're full of kind of a lovely scent.
You should call them fragrance bugs then, huh?
Something like that, I think. I guess I need to just emphasize that my mission is going to frustrate others, the thing that I'm doing. And while I know I need to do this with community, I also know that I need to only have those people that are on the left side of your curve in this community. Hence, the name here is Wheaton Laboratories. We're mm-hmm. going to push the envelope. We're going to try new things. And it's rare to have somebody who is willing to be on that bleeding edge of let's get new things done. Mm-hmm. The things that are not in any book right now or even on YouTube. And we're going to do things that are very, very different. And on top of that, it's a flavor of different that a lot of even other people that are pushing new envelopes, they might also be offended by. But it's a particular kind of push, a different kind of new thing. And I'm embracing the idea. And then one last thing is what you were saying something about. We're going back to arrogance and ego, and that is that I believe that anybody with the word arrogance or ego on their lips, and they're pointing at somebody else,
mm-hmm.
that it is not possible to utter the word with your finger out unless you've got plenty of it yourself. That person with arrogance or ego on their lips has to have arrogance or ego in order to be able to utter it and point or type it on the internet. In fact, you cannot post a comment to the internet or write an article or even enter into the conversation on the topic unless you have at least some degree of arrogance and or ego.
So can I respond?
Oh, please.
So when people use words like arrogance and ego and pointing fingers and calling people names, it tells me that they have a certain lack of skill in being more precise about what they are feeling as actual feelings and what they need in terms of basic universal human needs. If I say, you are a jerk, I've decided there's a category called jerk. I've decided that everybody knows what I mean by that. And then I say it, and I'm assuming that I'm making a true statement that will actually put you in your place, you jerk, and that other people know exactly what I mean. But what I think I might say if I was being completely much more authentic, much more honest, much more real with myself, much more in touch with myself, and much more good at communication skills, I'd probably say, when you said that thing, I felt really frustrated, and I also felt hurt, and I felt kind of scared, and I thought, damn. And it's because I care about having peace and ease and goodwill between us, and because I care about understanding what people said, and I didn't quite understand it. Okay, so let's say that I don't know how to say that. I don't know how to get in touch with what I'm feeling. I don't know how to get in touch with what I'm needing. I don't even know how to put words on these things. So I take the easy route. You're a jerk. I've called you something instead of communicating about what's going on with me. This happens all the time. It's basically the human system. So there are people who address this by suggesting that people learn some specific skills in how to communicate. One is nonviolent communication. You've heard of this. It's called NBC. There's another one called non-defensive communication. And this is a different other method, similar but different and easier to learn, I'd say, and easier to apply. And I've studied both of these, and I use them all the time except for when I get pissed off, and then I don't. And that's a joke, because that's when you should use it, you know. But the point is, there's a lot more to know about people's motivations. And so when people use words like somebody's a jerk, if somebody calls somebody a jerk, they're a jerk themselves, I think that there's a more precise and helpful way to say that. If somebody is accusing somebody of something in terms of their motivations or their actions or their demeanor, it may be that the person who's accusing is looking through a filter of their own unresolved issues and that they've got stuff going on, maybe the same thing, maybe some different thing. And that getting below the surface of name-calling is the first thing to do if you're going to try to get along well in a community. However, I have respect for and I completely understand your method, which is to have it be Wheaton Labs, your community in Montana, and to ask people to listen to all your podcasts first and to sort of get a sense of you before they would come there. And then when they get there, to agree to the agreements that you want people to agree to so that they all abide by those agreements. And that's so that in decision-making matters where you have the say, that you let them know that so that they can know that that's the way it is. And they can either choose to participate or not. To me, this seems authentic. It seems real. It seems honest. It seems above board. And I can't wait to visit you in Montana someday, which I hope I can. And it's like that's a way to do it. The way I do it is by learning as much as I can about communication skills and doing as much healing that I can get for my own psyche, because I'd like to be... You know how there's athletes who can do every kind of thing? They're like triathletes. They can run, they can swim, they can jump, they can play basketball, they can do everything.
Right.
Well, I'd like to be more multi-skilled in my ability to function well in this world. So I'm looking to be beneficial with every kind of person. Oh, knock on wood. Is that possible? I'm giving it a try. And also to take those things about me that are awful and get them some healing help so that I'm not subject to them and so that other people aren't either. And to take the things about me that are innate, natural, good gifts and let them shine because they were given to me. Not, I didn't make it up. They were given. And so let's take everything I'm good at and not obscure it with you know, my issues in the way. Then look at all the gifts that you have and all the good things you're good at. In my ideal world, people could see what you're offering and not get offended. But since you're thinking, well, you're getting offended, that's your problem, Jack, then, you know, and you just keep doing what you're doing, I think that's fine too, you know.
Well, now, you were saying something about how you wanted to improve yourself in certain things, and I hope that you don't try to improve yourself in certain areas by the values of others, but by when you go and you put a bunch of work into something that you're improving, it's like, I want to be better in this space. I think it's cool to be better in this space, and this is where I choose to grow, as opposed to like other people seem to be uncomfortable around me, and so I need to be a person that they can be comfortable around. Because now I think that what you're doing then is that you're going to reprogram yourself in a way that's fucked up.
Well, I can see why you'd say that if you weren't looking at it with the set of tools about understanding human nature that I currently have. There are people that I know who I believe are, and I wouldn't call them fucked up, although I know that people in the world would. I would say that they're suffering from terrible emotional pain that is suppressed and that they don't necessarily know they have it, but that they come from it. I was talking to a woman recently about the excellent relationship that I thought we'd had for several years where we're mutually benefiting each other and we're helping each other. There was a mediator there and two friends of ours, each of whom was friends of both of us, and I was asking her to please consider me the current me that I am today and not the me from the past, and to, you know, give me a break. And I thought we had a good relationship, and what she said is, we've had a terrible relationship for years, and you are trying to attack me and victimize me, and you're out to get me. You're going to make me pay. I was writing down what you said in my little notebook so that I wouldn't blurt out interruptions and so that I would be able to respond to what she said. And I was astonished to see that we were living in two different worlds. In her world, I was an ogre and a monster, and I was specifically out to victimize her. In my world, she and I were fine. I liked her. I appreciate her. I admire her, and I enjoy our nice relationship that we have. So somebody who would look at it this way might say, well, that person is a jerk. Or I would say, this is a person who is, she told me things about her life. She told me things about what her experience was in the nighttime when she'd wake up in panic attacks and what it was like when she would assume that people were, you know, trying to hurt her. And I realized that she was living inside of a world where attacks from bad, other, monstrous other people were happening all the time, whereas I lived in a world where that wasn't happening to her or to me. And the mediator later said to me, I was stunned by her response to you because you were being so empathetic and connecting and beneficial to her, extending her every kind of courtesy and respect genuinely and authentically, and she was blinded by her pain. And that's, he didn't say that in quotes, but I'm saying, oh God, that really leapt out of her. Yeah, blinded by her pain. She was blinded and goes through life like this, and my feelings of sadness were huge. I was sad for me because I couldn't get what I wanted, but that was kind of small. I was really sad that she goes through life like this. Now, P.S., I know what that feels like because I can remember it. Why? Because before the 100 and 200 years therapy, that was me. So it's not like I'm not able to relate. I can. I can remember what it feels like to be like that. And so I was meeting me in another body, but from the past. And I had enormous amounts of empathy and compassion. And I'm an ogre and a monster in her mind. What she is in my mind is not a jerk, but a person in tremendous pain. And I feel sad, and I wish there was some benefit or healing that could come to her somehow, some way. Sooner or later it will, evolution being an existing force. But, gosh, I wish she could have it right now. And so here we are. Is that person a jerk? Not her, but I mean a person. No, I don't even think like that. I don't even use words like jerk. But in communities, it does not help a person in a community to use hurtful, critical, put-down words like jerk and asshole about somebody else, and then to assume that that's got meaning and that we all agree on what the meaning is. It's really just a way to say, I don't like them and I feel bad. But it's not very clear and it's not very precise. It's kind of like sloppy thinking to say a jerk or a asshole. And so what I'd much rather do people do if they want to live in community is like we talked about at the beginning of our last podcast, which is please learn good communication skills. You'll need them. If you don't learn them, you can create a lot of trouble for you, somebody else, some several other people, or the whole community, because you might use words like jerk and asshole and write people off with arrogance, or you might think other people are attacking you and victimizing you. Please don't do that. That's my speech.
I think the meaning of jerk and asshole is possibly a little different, and I would say that these words are valid words. They give traction to what we're trying to convey in our knowledge set. And but I do think that the word jerk, to me, is possibly a bit richer than what most people, you know, toss about. First of all, I think most people think of jerk as a Boolean value. You either are or you are not. And but I prefer to think that a jerk is more of a real value, which is that it's going, rather than being a state of zero or one, then which is a Boolean, zero or one, that it's a real number of 0.00 up through 1.00. And so then somebody could be like a 0.76 jerk. Another person might be a 0.25 jerk. And I think that it's entirely possible that, you know, there are people that are going to be, well, it'd be effectively a bell curve, like we were talking about earlier, where most people gravitate to 0.5 on the jerk scale. And then when people are pointing at somebody else, because the other thing is not only is this jerk factor, and then plus you have to say that the jerk factor is not defined by yourself, but by others. And so how much of a jerk you are is going to be, you know, the people that are pointing at you and using the word. And then, so then if anybody does that, because, for example, you might think that Abraham Lincoln, what a smooth dude, he's not possibly a jerk, but John Wilkes Booth had a different opinion and voted, wow, super jerk, with a bullet. And so it's like, okay, well, we gotta embrace that Abraham Lincoln, to many people, was a jerk. And anybody who's accomplished anything of significance, we could point to and say, well, what a jerk. And there's different people that would, you know, qualify it differently. But I kind of feel like the perfectly pleasant people, the people that would, you know, be at like 0.1 or 0.2 on this scale, that what have they accomplished? And it's very possible that they've accomplished some very beautiful things privately. And it's, there are a few people that become well known, and they are extremely lovely people. But I think that that's more the exception than the rule.
Paul, it sounds as though you're saying, by implication, or maybe you're outright saying it, that there's a correlation between people on the continuum of jerkness, as however you may be describing that, defining that, and I think it has no definition because it can mean anything, and accomplishing things in the world, as though you're saying there is a one-to-one ratio. Accomplish things in the world, you'll be a jerk. If you're a jerk, you might accomplish things. If you aren't a jerk, maybe you never accomplish anything. Maybe you should be a jerk who accomplishes things.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay.
In fact, I'm leading up to the next part, which is that being a jerk is relative and subjective.
Of course. And it isn't even, the word doesn't even mean anything.
No, I find that the word means a great deal. So if somebody points at me and says jerk, then I'm totally okay with it because I feel like I just learned a lot about that person. That person's values are very different from mine. And so I hope that I look like a jerk to that person. And
because you'd rather look like a jerk from that person than a nice guy from that person because you think they're a jerk.
It does pain me when there are people that I think are wonderful people and they think I'm a jerk. That's painful. And at the same time, at this point in my life, it does not change my behavior.
Okay, well, you know what I think we should do?
What?
I think we should get back to thinking about people listening to this podcast who are looking for information about community. And I'm gathering that
I think this is an important part of community.
Right. I just want to tie it to our theme, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Forgive me. That's what I do. I try to help people know where we're at. Because a podcast is in the air, right? You're not reading it, and you don't get a summary of it. It's like going by in time rather than in space. So it seems to me there are these two differing views that you and I are offering to listeners about how to approach getting along with folks or not in communities. And I really wish people would believe me and not you.
Okay.
Because I would rather that they got along well rather than might dismiss various people as having this or that wrong with them.
I do wish for people to get along well. And at the same time, I've evolved a set of philosophies which I've not seen written anywhere else about this, but with my arrogance, then I believe in my philosophies despite the fact that I haven't found anything very corroborative about my philosophies. But, you know, and then what I'm doing now is I'm acting with my theories at this point. And I do believe, as much as something like nonviolent communication and many of the other communication tools out there serve to help people communicate, I also think that they serve to cause a non-communication. And when you and I talked about this last, then you're saying, well, they don't really understand it. And it's like, a lot of these people teach the stuff, and they are certain that they understand it better than everybody else, and they still use it as a weapon. I'm not saying that the tool is not a great tool.
Mm-hmm.
What I am saying is much like what you said earlier, that people in the world of psychiatry and psychology, some are better than others. Some really don't know what the hell they're doing. I think that there are people who teach these things that know it better than others.
Oh, I agree completely, Paul. I talked to a man who started restorative circles, which is a conflict resolution method that I highly recommend for communities. His name is Dominic Barter. He lives in Rio de Janeiro. I met him at a restaurant in Rio de Janeiro. It was very cool. And we were talking, and I was asking him about various things, and he is on the board of directors of the Center for Nonviolent Communication, which is the international board of the international teaching this stuff.
Okay.
And he's pals with Marshall Rosenberg, the guy who created it about 30 years ago, a psychiatrist who created it because he wanted the world to have more harmony and peace and good connections with each other. And so he said that Marshall Rosenberg told him that he thought only a small percentage of the people out there were trainers actually understood and could really do NVC, nonviolent communication, effectively. And Dominic told me that he thought that only a few people who do restorative circles facilitation really understand it and can do it effectively. And this is from the horse's mouth, right? Two horses, Marshall Rosenberg and Dominic Barter. So I thought, well, and then he said, but I believe that it's worth trying it and doing it anyway because it's better than not. And so, yeah, you'll find people who really make things worse when they're trying to do one of these things. Maybe not because they want to control and dominate or use a weapon, but because they're just kind of unskilled at it and their old patterns are getting in their way, you know. But I still highly recommend that if a group of folks is going to create a community or going to heal a community from its challenges, the three things I totally recommend are sociocracy, which is a governance structure and a decision-making method. It's called sociocracy, meaning governance by peers and colleagues. It's also called dynamic governance in the U.S., and the second one is nonviolent communication, and the third one is restorative circles. Even if we can't do them very well, I think it's better than not doing them.
This podcast is continued in part 3.